Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to learn about how to impact markers in our blood by the foods that we eat that will allow us to live a longer life. There's so much new research being done, independent research, that shows that, quite simply, what we eat will add years onto our life, or, if we don't eat right, take years off. I'll discuss that in depth today. Also today, we're going to be hearing from some different audio clips. I started this yesterday, and we got some good response, very articulate and insightful input from the audience, and I thank you for that. So we're going to look at how does one island become so different in the quality of life, even life expectancy? Well, that island is the Dominican Republic and Haiti. They both share the same island, completely different in how they live. We'll give you an insight on that. Also, for a lot of Americans who are struggling, and that's about 70% of all Americans, with just basics, young people in particular, they cannot go out and afford a home, and they can't afford rent. And yet in many of the places like Silicon Valley or San Francisco, where there are job opportunities, they can't afford to live there. What does this mean? Well, they're doing something that no one was paying attention to. So I'll give you a heads up. For those of you who thought that at least you could exist and have some quality of life, local communities are voting up higher property taxes, even if there is no increased value in your property. Why are they doing that? And in some cases, as much as 40% increase in 1 year. Wow. It means an awful lot of people are going to have to sell their homes who otherwise wouldn't. So it's a short-term measure where there's been poor financial planning, massive incompetence at the state and local levels, and now it's, well, the whole thing is tipping. So I'll play you a clip on that as well. And also, what does it mean when the Justice Department is refusing to turn over documents that clearly show that there was a conspiracy by people within the FBI and the CIA, the National Security Agency, and the Justice Department that impacted the American people? These agencies have been corrupt from the beginning, and it's unfortunate people don't recognize it. We'll play a little clip on that as well. We begin. And we're beginning with a study from the University of Portsmouth, which is in the United Kingdom, about stress. I can remember the first conversation I had with Dr. Hans Selye. He was the father of stress therapy in the whole world. Brilliant man. And he divided stress into two types. Good stress, the stress that we actually benefit from, things that excite us about. Well, there's a certain level of stress when we're being around people that we enjoy being around, going to a lecture, going to a workshop, a retreat. We're putting ourselves into another environment, one that we don't control. And so there's a certain level of stress. How are we going to get along? What are we going to learn? Will it be exciting? Will it be insightful? But that's a good stress. Even going away to a de-stress center, if you went away to a Buddhist center, which I recommend people do, they're very, very good, not to learn Buddhism, but just to practice some meditation in silence and being near nature. It's very relaxing, but there's a certain element of stress. Then there's negative stress, stress that causes your stress hormones to spike, and in that spiking, you damage your heart. And from that, we were able to show that the more angry you are, the more distressed you are, the shorter your lifespan and the more damage you're doing, because it's a pro-inflammatory response. So he had normal stress and he had distress. and he was the one that started it all. From that, there was a psychologist, a brilliant man named Lawrence Lachan. I had the privilege of being able, as a young and struggling scientist, to be working in the same environment with him at the Institute of Applied Biology. And we would sit and have conversations about what was predictable. And one day he said, what would you think if I brought 500 women, completely healthy, with no history of breast cancer in their family, and after a relatively brief conversation, no more than, let's say, a half hour, I was able to accurately predict if that person would develop breast cancer just based upon their emotions. And I thought, and I said, well, that's not anywhere in the scientific literature. You see, you're correct, it's not, but it should be, because it happens. He went on to do the first such study in completely healthy women with no history of breast cancer in their family, and the women, he was able to predict at a very high rate of accuracy over a 25-year period who would develop breast cancer. And it all happened about, he said, stress in infancy when you're young. It dramatically alters your body's DNA. No one else was saying this at the time. You couldn't verify it. Now it is completely verifiable. And later, the doctor from, he was the head psychiatrist of the city of New York, and Kessler, Jerry Kessler. And we had conversations, and he would talk about how you could predict disease patterns in people based upon how they felt appreciated or used. And those who felt used and unappreciated had a higher incidence of arthritis. So anyhow, they were the people who were the pioneers in this field. Now we go to the University of Portsmouth, and they're saying that stress in infancy, quote, dramatically alters your body's organs. Now this is something we did not know. So you're hearing something for the first time today. Scientists have found the first evidence suggesting emotional stress in infancy has significant and far-reaching effects on the body and can result in disease later in life. Psychological stress in infancy dramatically changes the amount of an important class of proteins called GABAA receptors, which in turn can alter the workings of the heart, the lungs, your kidney, and bladder. Now, it was already known that changes in the amount of GABAA receptors cause some brain disorders, but researchers at the University of Portsmouth are the first to show that stress can also alter their expression in other organs. And the research team in the School of Pharmacy and Biomedical Sciences studied the way GABAA receptors behave in secondary organs and when they're exposed to stress. This is very important. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Frontiers in Molecular Neuroscience. Quote from Dr. Jeremy Swiney, GABAA receptors were known to control brain activity and served as important targets for many drugs used in modern medicine to treat brain disorders such as epilepsy, anxiety, as well as inducing surgical anesthesia. We were surprised to find these proteins were also found to be expressed so widely beyond the brain. The dramatic stress-induced changes in the amounts of GABAA receptor compared to what one normally finds is intriguing. It will alter organ function and we suggest will contribute to diseases of those organs. And again, we're talking about your brain, but also your heart and your lungs. So, you know, and your kidneys, this is a big deal. And so you're hearing this first. No other television or radio program that I'm aware of has shared this information. And that's what we do. Find high-quality, evidence-based medicine, meaning good quality evidence that supports reasonable understandings of how the body functions. Now, why is this important to you? Because we now have another non-pharmacological field of therapy in the epigenetics that can determine that almost any form of stress and negative behavior that you were exposed to, trauma, early in life can impact how you manifest your energy as an adult, overreacting, needing control of a situation, being chronically fearful, not trusting people, not wanting to be vulnerable, keeping everything closed and tight, a very rigid disposition. In fact, a lot of people want to obtain a certain amount of power and authority simply to protect themselves because without even being conscious of it, their early life experiences of being vulnerable and not being able to control circumstance, now they say, I'm not going to let anyone hurt me ever again in my life. And you see this in relationships where people don't understand, why aren't you open? Why aren't you flowing with enthusiasm and creativity? And why can't you just laugh at things in life? Why is everything so rigid? And frequently it's because of even unconscious or subconscious things that happened earlier in life. So the good news is that now through different nutrients, including nutrients for the brain and nutrients for the organs, and through different forms of psychotherapy and meditation and tapping, that's where you visualize where you are suffering some abuse. Maybe you're sexually abused, maybe you're emotionally abused, maybe you're physically abused, or all the above, and you lock it in. You can tap that place, or better still, have someone like a Henry Grayson, or one of the real brilliant people in the field. And I've seen it. I filmed it. People who had suffered from long time, decades-long sexual trauma, and they were rigid. They couldn't feel anything. They had so emotionally and physically anesthetized themselves because of fear of being hurt. And he would do these, say these words and tap the person, like over and over again, same spot, and positive affirmations. And the whole body just relaxed, and it was as if a clamshell had opened, and you thought, wow. And then I followed it up with these people, and they were completely different later on. So you see, we've learned three things. That stress can be either constructive, or if it's distress, destructive. That when that distress happens early in life, we hold it in, and it can literally change the function of our organs, making us vulnerable to diseases later in life. But also, the good news is that we can change the epigenetic energy. We can release that energy. We can surrender it and also put in a new energy that liberates the tissue, liberates that, and allows it to heal so we can go forward as a completely different person. So that's good. Something else that I read from the University of Leipzig in Germany, published in Psychological Science, that, how can I put this? If you want to give a little boost to your life satisfaction a year from now, you may want to try socially focused strategies over strategies that involve non-social pursuits. And that's important. So what this research at the university showed was that people who came up with well-being strategies that involved other people were more satisfied with their lives 1 year later, even after taking into account that they were marginally happier to begin with. In contrast, people who came up with strategies that did not explicitly involve others remained, on average, the same as they were before. So, when you do something that is good and you involve someone else in some supportive way, your whole sense of satisfaction increases. And that is good. You could do the same thing without anyone and be satisfied, but not at the same level. For example, this summer, when I do not know, but I will be doing about a 2-week, maybe even 3-week caravan to look at issues so we can show the American public the truth of how other people suffer who are invisible. They have no advocates, no major advocates, and nothing is improving for them. It's only getting worse. And then show what could help these people. What could we do to make a difference? And so by just seeing the nature of a problem that you did not know existed, or if you were vaguely familiar with it, you hadn't experienced it up front. It's one thing to look at something over the internet and see a person that's sleeping on the streets in San Francisco. It's something else to be speaking with that person one-on-one, looking in the eyes and trying to understand, how did you get here? What is necessary to create as a support system to take you from where you're at to where you could at least enjoy a quality of life or start your journey back? And that is when you're engaging in something that is challenging, but at the same time, you're going to feel a lot better about yourself because you're actually doing something good. And it reminds me of a demonstration that happened some years back, not a long time ago, and it was over in Prospect Park. And I didn't know how many people would show up. 5? 100? Who knew? But 8,000 people showed up. And it was about making a march from Prospect Park in Brooklyn to Washington, D.C. over a couple-week period. And to end up in Lafayette Park, which is right across the street from the White House, in order to protest genetic engineering and to advocate for freedom of choice in labeling, so we have labels that tell us is something genetically engineered or not. And we had an enormous crowd. And when I got down to Washington, D.C., and I was filming my commentary, afterwards I was walking and talking with the people, and I said, why'd you come? This was a big deal. You know, you had to take at least 2 weeks out of your life. And now we're going to play a segment from Tucker Carlson about how the House Freedom Caucus is drawing up articles of impeachment against Rob Rosenstein, the second command at the Justice Department. Why? And why is this important? Because the left, and those of us from the liberal community, as well as many in the conservative movement, in the 1960s and 70s, saw an FBI, Justice Department, the national security state was simply out of control. They had infiltrated all of the peace activist movements, the environmental movement, the feminist movement. In effect, they considered anyone who challenged the state, the federal government and its agencies, or corporate America, as being, for all intents and purposes, a domestic terrorist. And then we had a very brave senator, Senator Church, and his hearings were such a wellspring of insight when he questioned about how many people in the media are your assets to the former CIA director, and he said many. It turned out to be 1,200 plus. So if that was in the 1970s, how many people in the media does the CIA or the National Security State control today? How many people in official positions, power positions, at the head of all agencies, are really there to do the bidding of the oligarchs, the deep state? So now, for the first time, because of Trump's election and their overreaction to Trump, had they just left Trump be, he would have made the mistakes he was going to make in any case, and he wouldn't have been reelected. But they put everything in one basket, destroyed Trump. Well, now they've also destroyed their chances to have a sweep to get back into power. But had they been back in power, then we would have all gone back to knowing nothing, no transparency, everything opaque, no discussion of deep state, no discussion of the who controls the banking system, the Federal Reserve, the military-industrial complex. None of that would have been up for discussion. But now it is. So listen to what Tucker Carlson has to say. And I believe it's important because we need to hold people who are working against our best interest accountable. We've held no one accountable. Oh, except the whistleblowers, you know, the people that actually risk their lives and careers to expose crimes against humanity and malfeasance and illegalities. And for exposing these, they end up in prison. And the people perpetrating these crimes, they stay in power. That's why this is important to listen to. Now, Tucker Carlson.
You may have heard about a new battle between Congress and the Department of Justice. A group of congressional Republicans is demanding that the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, release a series of documents related to the Russia investigation. They say they plan to impeach Rosenstein if he doesn't turn over the information. So far, Rosenstein has defiantly refused to do that. Now, before you tune this out as yet another partisan arcane debate, the kind that Washington specializes in, hear the details, because it's not that. There's a lot at stake here, far beyond the short-term political advantage of either party. The Russia investigation, as you know, has completely dominated the business of government since the day Trump took office. It's all anyone in Washington can talk or think about, never mind the potential wars on the horizon in Asia or the Middle East, or the fact our own economy and culture are changing faster than anyone can understand or digest. In D.C., only the Mueller investigation matters. So you may wonder, what is the Mueller investigation? What is it about? What exactly is Mueller investigating? Turns out, almost nobody knows, except Rod Rosenstein. He knows, but he won't tell Congress. Last summer, Rosenstein wrote a memo detailing the scope of the independent counsel investigation. Key portions of that memo remain hidden from view. Congress would like to see them and has every right to see them. Our Constitution requires our elected representatives to supervise the Department of Justice. Why is that? Well, so that bureaucrats with massive law enforcement and surveillance powers remain accountable to voters. We give them guns, let them arrest us, send us to prison, allow them to break into our private email accounts, tap our phones. They have a lot of power. In return, they promise not to misuse that power. And if there's any question about their honesty, we get to check. That's what transparency is. Government bureaucrats hate transparency. They'd rather do their work in secret. Secrecy is the shield that protects them from our scrutiny, and not just in this case. Consider the House Intelligence Committee investigation into Russian collusion. It was just completed. It took a year to complete. The final report ran to 253 pages. Yet the rest of us couldn't really read it because key facts were missing. Just how many Trump associates did the Obama administration spy on during the 2016 campaign? It would be nice to know that. Sorry, it's redacted. Is there any actual proof that the Russian government directed hacking of the DNC and John Podesta's Gmail account? Well, if there is, that's been redacted too. Or how about this? The report says that the FBI agents who interviewed Mike Flynn didn't believe he was lying. But wait. Mike Flynn pleaded guilty to lying to those agents, and his life was destroyed as the result. He just sold his house to raise money for his legal defense. So what's going on here? Well, we don't know. That information was redacted. Why were all these redactions made? We don't even know that. We asked. No one would tell us. And then there's the FISA application to spy on Trump campaign aide Carter Page. That hasn't been released either, even though we now have ample reason to believe the application may have been fundamentally illegitimate, based heavily on discredited partisan hearsay, the Steele dossier. Jim Comey denies this, of course. He's denied it repeatedly on his book tour. Just the other day, he noted, smiling faintly as he said it, that there's no way to check, really, because it's classified. The joke is on us, except it's not funny. Almost nobody trusts the government anymore, and that's one subject that both sides can agree on. There's only one way to fix that, sunlight. Stop hiding, stop lying, tell us what's really going on. Rod Rosenstein has no intention of doing any of that. In an interview today at the museum, Rosenstein compared demands for greater transparency from Congress to a mafia shakedown. Watch.
There have been people who have been making threats privately and publicly against me for quite some time. And I think they should understand by now the Department of Justice is not going to be extorted. We're going to do what's required by the rule of law. And any kind of threats that anybody makes are not going to affect the way we do our job.
little victim. Extorted? How about accountable? Nobody elected Rod Rosenstein to anything or any of these people. They work for us, supposedly on our behalf. When they won't explain what they're doing or why they're doing it, it is a sure sign, always and everywhere, that they have begun to work against us. That's what it means. Joe DeGeneva is a former U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, and he joins us now. It's hard to believe that just happened, that Rod Rosenstein, about whom I was ambivalent until today, would get out there and attack the Congress, which has constitutional oversight over his department, as mafia members, in effect, for asking for what the Constitution demands they have, which is oversight.
The Deputy Attorney General today disqualified himself from continued service in the Department of Justice. Jeff Sessions now has an absolute responsibility to call him into his office, berate him for saying that constitutional oversight is extortion. That statement by a constitutional officer like Rod Rosenstein is disgraceful. It's an embarrassment to the department, but it is of a pattern of what Mr. Rosenstein has done there since he arrived. He is a careerist. He believes that the department can do no wrong and that he is going to resist calls for more information. When you realize that he appointed a special counsel, Robert Mueller, someone that he's very close to and who was very close to James Comey, to investigate no crime and put this country through 15, going on 16 months of interruption of a new president, that tells you something about Rod Rosenstein. He is resisting all of this because he created the original sin, an investigation of no crime.
I'm just confused, though. I mean, Rod Rosenstein has a gun. He has the power to arrest you or me. Lying to him is a felony. He has a lot of power. Where does he think that power comes from, if not from the Congress and the voters who elected those members of Congress?
When you are as arrogant and as deep in the belief that you have been given a duty to do whatever you think is right for the country, and when you hate the president of the United States, as I am now convinced Mr. Rosenstein does, then you believe you can do anything. And when the attorney general—
Just because God made you all powerful or something? Like, where, do they not understand where the power comes from? Voters. That's the only place it comes from.
He does not understand it, because as a careerist and someone who has never left government for a minute to speak of any note, government is all he knows. And for him, the most important thing is the next job. And I can assure you the one thing he doesn't want to happen is to be held in contempt or to be impeached, because he believes himself to be something very, very special, an unaccountable bureaucrat.
So the DOJ, and there are some great people who work there, and
yes,
I know
are.
Some of them,
yes.
And I spoke to one of them today and said, why not, why doesn't the Congress, why doesn't the public have a right to know what this is about? And this person said, well, it's an ongoing investigation. And I guess my argument would be the public's need to know what this is about supersedes that. But tell me your view.
The answer is it's not an ongoing investigation. There is no crime. They've already conceded that the president is not a target. They're asking those 49 questions that they want to ask the president, and maybe even with a grand jury subpoena, because they want to impeach the president. This has nothing to do with a criminal investigation. Donald Trump has done nothing wrong. He's conspired with no one. The reason they are threatening a subpoena, well, go ahead, please issue the subpoena, because it will be an unconstitutional subpoena, an illegal subpoena, because there is no authority under federal law to issue a subpoena to a president of the United States to get testimony from him so it can be used in an impeachment proceeding. That use of the grand jury is illegal, absolutely illegal.
This may be a debate that
we are halfway through our program. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come right out of the break. And we're going to go to this property tax clip. It's only 2 minutes long, but it's very important. Please stay with us.
Facing an unpleasant surprise in the mail, their property taxes spiking. higher bills creating fears about their bottom lines. Here's ABC's Adrian Banker.
It's a shock in the mail.
I'm angry. I feel blindsided.
Across the U.S., homeowners like Maribel Selva in Chicago are seeing their property taxes skyrocket. She currently pays around $10,000 for her home, but just was notified her property tax bill will go up nearly 40%.
That's a whopping number. How can you justify this?
Municipalities facing budget deficits are now being accused by some of forcing homeowners to share the pain. In Clark County, Nevada, Las Vegas homeowners saw property taxes jump 38%. In Philadelphia, almost every neighborhood has seen an increase. But if you do get a high bill, you can appeal.
You need either an appraisal or a well-documented argument as to why the value isn't as high as the local government might think.
Experts also say talk to your neighbors or realtors in the area to see if they notice similar tax spikes. Start your appeal with the assessor's office.
You may not get much of a benefit in the first year of the cost reduction, but you will see those savings if you continue living in your home.
Maribel says she's worried these rising taxes could change the face of her neighborhood.
There's just no winners.
And the hit is especially painful for some since new tax reform laws now cap state and local deductions to just $10,000 annually. And if you do appeal, the process could take up to a year, Tom.
And it could cost more money, but it could work out.
Okay. Here's the problem, and here is the solution. What has happened is you've had a lot of careerists engage in community activity or become a part of local boards, and everything is about expand. Just look at New York City's city council. Look at all their pet projects. Look at the friends they have or business associates or people that they're aligned with that they give money to. At the same time, they're not turning the millions of square feet of empty space into living housing space for homeless people in New York City or for drug and mental problem rehabilitation. We have a lot of people in jails who shouldn't be there to begin with, who have mental conditions that have to be addressed, and they're not being addressed. You put a mental person into a prison system, first of all, the guards are just going to beat him to death. As they did, they scolded one man to death, and nothing seems to happen about this. So we should be building humanistic centers for people who are in crisis with the resources we have. But instead of doing that, it's all about gentrification of neighborhoods. It's about getting more young people with money and educations into a neighborhood. What happens to the people who are there? That's irrelevant. What happens to the quality of life of neighborhoods that have been there for centuries? Too bad. So everyone is overexpanded. And whatever money you had last year, they want more money this year, just like the military-industrial complex. Do they need $700 billion above line? No, they do not. How much do we need to actually defend ourselves? About $200 billion. But we're spending $1.3 trillion above and beyond what most people anticipate when all is said and done. And in one case, there were 10 contractors doing the same identical work for work we didn't even need to begin with on a cost-plus basis. So the more they run up a bill, the more they get paid at astronomical expenses, and yet nothing is done to change it. So local communities are not changing. State communities are not changing. As I'm talking about governmental agencies and national. So I believe that we should start to withdraw our energy from those places because you're not going to change them. The corruption is too deep. It's too systemic. When I had a beautiful home on Lake Apacon in New Jersey, and it was the oldest home on Lake Apacon, and it was wonderful to drive out there on the weekends. That's why I'd go and I'd sit on, I'd take my dogs and I'd sit on the deck, and I would write. And that's where I'd write my books and articles and commentaries. Come back early Monday morning, 4 o'clock, I'd be on the road, no traffic, get right in, 54 minutes. And then one day I sold my property. Why? Because even back then, 1985, they had increased my property taxes to over $20,000 a year. Today it's probably around $60,000. It's just a house on a lake. And so we, the people, have no say-so of to how our money is spent, to how much is wasted. We've all seen massive corruption in state governments, and that the people, the politicians, most are not there to serve us or make the communities better. And now they're doing it with properties. All your property is suddenly worth this amount. Well, hold on a second. It's not. I couldn't sell my property for 40% more, but we're going to tax you for it. Why? Because we're not willing to make any changes and reduce how we spend money. So get into cities or get into communities where they're not escalating. The single best state for living in right now, in my opinion, is Texas, Northeast Texas. Don't have sales taxes like we have. Don't have personal income tax, state income tax. New York, my goodness, is 64% taxes that those of us who live there have to pay. And what do we get for it? Living in New York and doing business in New York is like having Tony Soprano as your partner. Every government that can sticks his hand in your pocket to extract money and gives you nothing in return of value except harassment. So at a certain point, you're not going to beat the machine. And people are not going to change. Politicians are not going to change. You, in effect, have to see a system collapse under its own hubris and corruption before you can create a better system. Trying to redeem a system is like trying to get an addict with just a promise to go off drugs. It doesn't work that way. And right now, virtually all of our communities, governments, and state governments, and federal government are like out-of-control addicts. And they're not looking for change, recovery, detoxing, or redemption. They're just looking at the idea that people are too lazy and set in their comfort ways to change, so just keep taxing them more. And for a lot of people, that 30 to 40% increase in taxes to pay for the massive bureaucracies they've created, then stop the nonsense with bureaucracies or move. And we don't have the power yet to change. In time, when the system breaks down, and it will, in time, sooner rather than later, because the environment's going to play a big role in this. Did you see the flooding, the worst in Maryland history? All those businesses that were on the street level, all destroyed. Every single one destroyed. Who would have thought? Ask any of those people the day before the storm, 2 days ago. What do you think if a storm came through here that was so bad that it would destroy your business? And they'd look at us, well, we've never had such a storm and we'll do fine. Until yesterday and now, it's not fine. So nature will be a corrective influence on our excesses and living in the wrong place at the wrong time. But it's happening. It's speeding up. Now let's hear from George Carlin, who, if he were alive today, probably wouldn't be able to get a gig anywhere because of his lack of political correctness. Oh, by the way, Dick Gregory wouldn't, Lenny Bruce wouldn't, Sophie Tucker wouldn't, Shelley Berman wouldn't, Mort Saul wouldn't, Don Rinkles wouldn't. In fact, most people, you would have to have a separate room from the comedy venue with pillows, psychologist, and milk and cookies with teddy bears for those who can't handle their kind of mocking of truth. George Carlin.
Now we're going to lighten up a little bit. We're going to go back to advertising, and we're going to go on a little hunt. Going to look at some advertising lingo, especially food advertising. You know the people. Fresh, natural, hearty, old-fashioned, homemade goodness in a can. That kind of stuff. So let's take a look. Let's take a look at some of these words. Old-fashioned. When you hear old-fashioned, you're supposed to think, oh, this goes back to the old days. Right. The old days. Before we had sanitation laws. Before hygiene became popular. Back when botulism was still considered a sauce. Homemade. You see, homemade in the restaurants, too. Homemade soup. I don't care how much the amphetamine-driven waitress with the Marlboro lines in her face reminds you of your mother, the soup is not homemade. Unless someone is living in the kitchen. And if that's the case, I want to get a good look at this mother. I want to check this guy for lesions, carbuncles, impetigo, pink eye, and ringworm. And head lice. At any time they add the word style to another word, someone is pulling your prick. Old style goodness. What does that mean? Nothing. It means nothing. New York style deli. It means it's not located in New York. That's all it means, or they wouldn't have to say it in the first place. It's located in Calgary, and the owner is from Hong Kong. And the food tastes like things that the Bangladeshis throw away. Family style restaurant. You know what that means? It means there's an argument going on at every table. Two people are crying, and the eldest male is punching the women. Families. Then you have gourmet. Here's another word the advertising cretins have completely wiped us with. Gourmet. Gourmet dining in a cup. Gourmet cuisine in a can. By the way, whenever you hear cuisine in place of food, be prepared to pay an extra 80%. Gourmet rolls. Gourmet coffee. Gourmet pizza. These things do not exist. You want to know a gourmet food? Toasted snail penises. Candied moosebumps. Deep dish yak. Gourmet. It's the same with buttery and lemony and chocolatey. Real chocolatey goodness. You know what that means? No chocolate. And beware when they add the word flavored to another word. Lemon-flavored drink. No lemons. Now, one more food word before I completely change the subject on you. Natural. This is directed to all you health food fiends and environmental nitwits and yupsuckers who are running around. The word natural is completely meaningless. Everything is natural. Nature includes everything. It's not just trees and flowers. It's everything. A chemical company's toxic waste is completely natural. It's part of nature. We're all part of nature. Everything is natural. Dog is natural. It's just not real good food.
George Carlin. With the capacity to offend everyone. By the way, tonight on the Progressive Commentary Hour, Dr. Peter Glidden is going to be on, and we're going to take a look at the failure of conventional medicine, iatrogenic injury, and the professional medical establishment's assault on natural and alternative medicine. It's going to be a very powerful hour at 7 p.m. on PRN.FM. Now, I'd like to hear from people in the audience on the following issue, and that is, why aren't we, as a society, based on your perception, why aren't we getting off the grid? Why aren't we, for example, stopping going to the big box stores or buying clothes without looking first at the label? Where is it made? Is it union made? Good. Is it made using a fair labor practice and a good quality income? Good. If it's made in Bangladesh or another country that uses, for all intents and purposes, slave labor, then no, it shouldn't be. Why can't we break this addiction to buying more than what we need to load our life up with what amounts to toxic and useless stuff? Why aren't we going out of our way to study more about what we're actually using? Why do we stay intentionally ignorant on what's important? Why? Because you could take one example and apply it to almost everything. Why don't more parents question the curriculum, let alone how it's taught? Why don't we question our own capacity to add to the environmental disasters happening? When you're eating a hamburger, you're eating a cheeseburger, you're contributing to methane. So each one of us who does the wrong thing is contributing to our own destruction sooner rather than later. It doesn't have to be a tidal wave or methane gas. It can be a heart attack or a stroke. There are many different ways that karma comes to meet us. Why? 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Also, why is it today that we're not hearing more from the spiritual feminists? I mentioned yesterday that I would share today some names. I didn't have time yesterday. But when I look back over my own career of trying to help on feminist causes, writing several books on feminism, including one of the longest, if not the longest book, 1,600 pages on For Women Only with Barbara Seaman, we had a conversation once because we're out on the road, and she was this wonderful, wise, older woman. And she asked me, Gary, why do you care? Did you read or hear something from others that motivated you? And I thought for a moment. I said, well, what about Sojourner Truth and the women's rights and civil rights activists back in the 1880s? Yes, I was aware of it. And Simone de Beauvoir, the journalist, the philosopher, the women's rights activist. What about Susan Anthony, the journalist and publisher and editor and civil rights activist, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, back at 1900, 1902, the civil rights activist, and Margaret Fuller, back in the mid-1800s, the literary critic and writer and women's rights activist, and Mary Wollstonecraft, back in the 1700s, a scholar and one of the first women's rights activists in America, and Julia Ward Howe, the poet and civil rights activist, and Pearl Buck from my state, West Virginia, civil rights activist. People remember her for The Good Earth, but my goodness, she was so much more prolific than that one book. And Lillian Wald, the children's activist and nurse and labor activist in the 1940s, and Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic Workers and religious leader and anti-war activist, and Rosalie Edge, the early environmental activist, and Susan Sontag, journalist and the women's activist, and Mary Walker, the surgeon and doctor back in the early 1900s, and Margaret Mead, the anthropologist and women's and civil rights activist, Jane Addams, the anti-war activist, and Marie Curie, Amelia Earhart, Harriet Tubman, Anne Frank, Helen Keller, Joan of Arc, Florence Nightingale, Clara Barton. But then look at the contemporary people like Alice Walker and Angela Davis and Vandana Shiva and Marianne Williamson and Charlene Spretnak and Angel Toya Williams and Joanna Macy, Joan Halifax, and Winona LaDuke and Sister Elizabeth McClaster and Daisy Kahn and Joan Bolan, Jean Bolan and Elizabeth Satoris, who I'm having on the show, I believe, next week, and the Reverend Sally Bingham, who is the Episcopal priest at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, and Len Twist and Joanna Macy, Joan Halifax, and Joan Borisenko, who I interviewed out in San Francisco, and Karen Baker Fletcher, and Reverend Jesuna Palmo, great Himalayan activist, and Sister Joan Chisister, chair of the Global Peace Initiative for Women, and Sharon Salzberg, and Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum, and Daisy Kahn, Starhawk, and many more. These are women who, in my opinion, should be front and center in discussing equality and working together, men and women, as our capacity for equal opportunity, equal reward, respect, and a love for the essence of the other, of who we are. We're all spiritual beings. We may act different, fine. We may have different backgrounds, which we do. But at the end of the day, you like someone because they touch your heart and they make you smile, or you don't because they're narcissistic and rude and insensitive. For too long, it is my personal opinion that the feminist movement has been captured by those who, even though at a political level, are wanting, and I believe they're sincere, to see women have greater gains, so often in that dialogue is men are all the problem. That if you're just a man, or you're a white man, or you're a black man, you're the problem. And then there's this kind of common voice around them. But where are these other voices? You would hear a completely different dialogue, one of healing, one of conciliation. And we're not able to hear those voices at this time. So I'm going to be bringing these people on the air as some sense of counterbalance to the hard, rigid, in-your-face, super alpha female that controls so much of what goes on television or in the media. And people are afraid of them. And that's unfortunate. We shouldn't be afraid of people from any movement who are there supposedly to see that our rights are protected and there is equality and respect for one another. But we're not there yet. So expect over the next year on a regular basis to be hearing from spiritual feminists. They don't hate men and they don't blame men. If we wanted to be concerned, we should look at the oligarchs and the people who control how we think, control our education, control the propagandizing. And then we would better understand this problem that we're in today. And where are the activists looking for all those poor people, the senior citizens who are hungry, the children who are hungry, the homeless people? Why don't we see them on MSNBC? Why don't we see their stories in the nation? Why don't we hear from them? I spoke with a person after Labor Day because I did a show at 6 o'clock with Kathy Davis yesterday honoring veterans. And as I said, I'm against the wars that they have fought in. I'm against the policies that they were indoctrinated in. I'm against the type of training they had that desensitized them to what it means to be the other. But I'm not against them. It is not my right to judge them for their actions. They are in need of help. Homeless, sick, dying, stressed, no assets, no support system. And yet, when I spoke with someone, they said, well, I wouldn't help those people. Why not? Well, they were out there bombing and droning. Went through that, and I said, hold on a second. Every day, people are doing things that even unconsciously they contribute to some other loss of the environment. If you're eating a hamburger, you're contributing to global warming. Should we condemn you because you're eating an animal with no sensibility to the what it is to be that sentient being? I'm not going to judge you because you eat animals. If you need help, if you need a different way of understanding what that help means, I'm there to help you. So I think it's a time that we stopped acting as if we can be justified in being victims of someone else's, let's say, misappropriated life lessons. We shouldn't be condemning everything in the world. We should be looking at how do we heal. You help a person heal. More often than not, you'll help them change their perception of how they got sick. When they change their perception of how they got sick, they start disconnecting from the things that one time they believed unequivocally and absolutely. And then one day you wake up and we're a different person. We're living a different life. And you don't do that by bludgeoning people. You don't beat people into believing in your way. And if we can't have empathy and see what is sacred still in those who are suffering, then what exactly are you going to align yourself with? And how is that going to make it a better world? Just a question to ask ourselves. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. And to Jess from Queens, we'll take your call tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.